Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. An article in the New York Times caught our attention on November 12, when Republicans take power. The author writes, a few months from now, it's all but certain Donald Trump will nominate and the Senate will confirm a new conservative Supreme Court justice. At that point, Republicans will control all three branches of government. Rarely have they won this trifecta of power. Over the past 7 decades, Republicans controlled the presidency in both houses of Congress for just 6 years, 2 under Dwight Eisenhower and 4 under George W. Bush. What will Republicans do with their newfound power? How will the exercise of that power change the party? That's the focus of our conversation this hour. And we welcome Jeffrey Cabaservice, who's a historian of the Republican Party and the author of Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. We'll be welcoming phone calls. He has much to say in his interesting article, and we'll get into it this hour. Join us at 1-800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us at Twitter, and that is @KDunnShow. Jeffrey, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi. Nice to be with you.
And thanks for writing the article. Let's jump to the last part of the article for a moment, because this was the focal point of his win. This was why he won. You write about Trump's support, the swing states of the Midwest, including Wisconsin, from white working class voters who missed out on the economic recovery, have felt victimized by globalization and elites. Trump, from what he said during the campaign, is different than what some Republican leaders have emphasized in terms of trade, immigration, cutbacks in Social Security and Medicare. How does he make the economy work for all these people who put him in office? And do you think that he will act on that? Would it be wise for him to act on that immediately?
Well, you know, it's a question of whether he's going to govern as he campaigned. That's a question you have to ask of every person
right.
who wins the presidency, because often what's said for the benefit of supporters is not necessarily what gets followed when the person ascends to higher office. But, you know, I think some elements of Trump's plan to put the Midwest back to work are evident in what he says. He would like to actually do a deal with Democrats to have a big rebuild of the infrastructure. America's infrastructure, both parties agree, is in terrible shape, and the investment needed may be more than $1 trillion. So surely there would be jobs in there for some people. Trump also is a big proponent of reviving American manufacturing. And it could be that he seeks to do that in some measure through trade reform, whether it's through making sure that there's no currency manipulation going on with our partners, or, as he says, renegotiating our trade agreements. And it's also forgotten that American manufacturing at the advanced vanguard level is actually doing pretty well. And, in fact, some of the problems of manufacturers, even in places like Wisconsin, is that they can't get enough highly qualified workers. So it may be that Trump throws his support behind retraining and upskilling programs, something he briefly mentioned in his campaign, although he hasn't said much about that lately.
Mm-hmm. Can he get $1 trillion to rebuild our infrastructure?
Well, this is interesting because he would find that the obstacle to that price tag would probably come from within his own party. There's a great deal of resistance to just straight-up funding of infrastructure construction, modernization, and repair from the conservative segment of the Republican Party. Democrats would probably be more than happy to give what they would see as a kind of economy-stimulating infrastructure spending here. So it may actually be that Trump will have to negotiate a hardball with Paul Ryan rather than with anyone on the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm. A lot has been said the last couple of days, as you well know, about the appointment as a senior advisor, the top advisor to him, of Steve Bannon from Breitbart. You in your piece talk about the direction of white nationalism, which could turn off college-educated white voters who still form a big part of the Republican coalition. Do you worry? Do you see that happening here, or is it way too early to tell if this administration is going in the direction of white nationalism?
I think it's too early to tell. And, you know, what one does actually hear here in Washington is that some Republicans are actually encouraged by the fact that Trump did better among certain minorities than did Mitt Romney. So, for example, Trump apparently got a higher percentage of the Hispanic vote And in some states like Florida, Trump got one out of every three Hispanic votes, and in Cuba and among Cuban Americans, even 54% of their vote. So the question is, you know, there is obviously a problem for the Republican Party just based on simple demographics if it becomes a party limited to whites. Certainly Hispanics are the fastest growing segment of the population. It would seem to be suicide for a party to turn its back on any segment of that population. And as I did say, a party that openly went toward white nationalism would also turn off a lot of other people who are not minorities.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, Steve Bannon, it's really hard to tell, frankly, what he's up to and how he would function in the Trump administration. So I do think it's too early to tell there.
Do you think that Trump will keep him?
I do think he'll keep him until such a time, if it happens, that Bannon says something outrageous and Trump has to break with him.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what he is likely to do and how he's likely to govern in the months following his inauguration. Those are important months. If you've got an agenda, you're just going to be going ahead with that as quickly as you can. Do we have any sense of how he will govern in the months following his election, February, March, April, May?
Again, there's just an awful lot about Trump that no one can predict. No one has predicted what he would do to this point. But it's a good guess that Trump will, in the very early days of his administration, use the power of executive orders to rescind a lot of the executive orders that were passed mm-hmm. under Obama. It'll be kind of a tit-for-tat operation. And you can expect that a lot of these will affect things like Obama's climate change orders, perhaps some of his climate orders on immigration, perhaps health care and gun control as well. And as I said in my piece, this won't inspire bipartisanship by any means. But the question is, how far will Trump go on these executive orders? And then what happens, particularly in the Congress, when it comes to things that are not so easily rescinded? My guess is that the Congress is not going to move as quickly as many Republicans would like when it comes to something like repealing the Affordable Care Act, because even now you're starting to hear a lot of Republicans back away from the idea of simply repealing it without replacing it. But there's a lot of hard thinking and heavy lifting that the party has to do to come up with an Obamacare repeal, given that the solutions it's put forward have really been quite sketchy to this point.
Mm-hmm. And do you imagine that somewhere there are solutions that are much less than sketchy? There is a plan somewhere, is there?
You know, Heritage has a plan. There was something that came from Fred Upton of Michigan and I think John Thune. That is a more rudimentary plan. But the problem is the Republicans haven't really made up their minds as yet as to how they make it work if they keep the appealing parts of the Affordable Care Act. In other words, the provision that people can allow their children to stay on their insurance, that insurance companies aren't allowed to discriminate against patients with pre-existing conditions, and also what is to be done with the 20 million Americans who've acquired health insurance since Obamacare was passed in 2010. I don't think Republicans really know at this point how much coercion they can or should require of the healthy young invincibles who don't like to buy life insurance because they don't, or health insurance because they don't think that they need it, but whose participation is needed to make the program solvent. So there's still a lot of questions that they have yet to answer.
Mm-hmm. And let's look more thoroughly at trade and climate change. You write in your piece about GOP constituents, and I wonder how many there are who may force revision on issues like trade and also on climate change.
Well, they exist. In the House, there was a resolution that was put forward last year stating that climate change is real and caused by humans and that something needs to be done about this. That got 13 signatories in the House, which is not a lot, but these are all Republicans, and this, I think, is the start of something. There are also even Republican climate super PACs and other organizations out there like Jay Faison's Clear Path Action Group. So there is already some interest in climate change on the Republican side. Even someone like Donald Trump has said that he's in favor of renewable energy like wind and solar. But the question is, you know, how much are the proponents right now of climate change going to stand up against the other part of the party who would really like to see serious exploitation of coal and natural gas and who aren't that concerned about global warming or even think it might be a hoax?
What about all the divisions in the Republican Party, Jeffrey? You write about libertarians, social conservatives, fiscal conservatives, neoconservatives. Can they unite on certain issues? If so, what might they be? And what's going to cause friction among all of those different factions?
Well, you know, again, my analysis prior to the election was like a lot of other people's analysis. It was predicated on this widespread belief that Hillary Clinton was going to win.
Yes, right.
And we were all wrong. And, you know, I had anticipated that there actually would be something of a bloodbath between these different factions in the Republican Party. But victory changes a lot of things. And as someone like Tom Cole, representative from Oklahoma, said recently, you know, the mood in the Republican conference right now is all roses and sunshine. And so yesterday, Paul Ryan was renominated as Speaker of the House without a single dissenting vote. And in fact, one of the founders of the House Freedom Caucus, who had really been very opposed to Ryan and the whole GOP establishment, Mick Mulvaney of South Carolina actually put Ryan's nomination in play. So right now, the emphasis is on unity, and you aren't going to see a whole lot of arguments, probably not even during the lame duck session. But once the new Congress has convened in January, that's when you'll start seeing the real battles break out again between the different factions.
Why is everything so rosy now?
Again, you know, the feeling is that the Republicans, against their own expectations, won the presidency. And they want Donald Trump to have a smooth and pleasant honeymoon for as long as he can, given the fact that a lot of Americans are deeply set against him. And they don't want to be a cause of further distraction right now. But again, this doesn't mean that Freedom Caucus people, let's say, have given up on their priorities. They haven't. We'll be likely to see those once normality has reasserted itself, I guess you could say, come January.
What does it mean for the country? This is interesting historically, for the Republicans to control all three branches of government.
Well, it's something we haven't really seen since the 1920s. And, you know, there's been a lot of speculation. Are a lot of Americans in a mood to go back to the 1920s? But, you know, the reality is that the last time Republicans were regularly counted among the governing powers who controlled at least the Congress and the presidency, it hasn't been since the 1920s. Whereas if you go back in the period from 1933 onwards, Democrats have had control of both houses of Congress for 34 years, at least by my calculations, as against six by the Republicans. So it's in one sense just a lack of familiarity with what goes along with total control of the government and the kind of responsibilities that go with it, and the fact that a lot of the conservative movement that undergirds the Republican Party is really happier being in opposition. And it's going to be a shift for them to get into team player mode.
Interesting. And from what we've heard, I know it's very early here, but we keep hearing reports that there's a great deal of dissension at Trump Tower among people who want so-and-so to be in the cabinet and a lot of internal fighting that's going on. Are there indications that, because they aren't very used to having total control of the government, that they don't know what to do at this point with total control of the government?
Yeah, that's a fair statement, I think. I think that a lot of the mechanisms that would have shifted smoothly into place to fill federal positions if Hillary Clinton had won the presidency simply aren't there on the Republican side. It's been too long since the Bush administration, and a lot of the mechanics have grown rusty. And in addition, there's the fact that Trump campaigned as an outsider, and so there aren't a lot of the old insiders working in his campaign to smooth the way.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them here momentarily. We're talking about the fact that Republicans will soon, because of nomination and confirmation of a Supreme Court justice, have all three branches of government. What does that mean? What indications are there in terms of how Donald Trump will govern? What about the divisions that have existed when it comes to issues that he campaigned on, trade, immigration, Affordable Care Act, and how there might be different points of view among other Republicans who, as our guest said, at the moment everything is rosy. Will it continue to be rosy? What do you expect? What do you expect as someone who have voted for Donald Trump, or you voted for somebody else? Nobody expected this to happen, so we're all looking at what might happen next. What do you think? We welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Jeffrey Cabaservis is a historian of the Republican Party. He's the author of Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. We have lines open for you. Feel free to use our Facebook page, too. We get messages there, which we read on the air, the Kathleen Dunn Show, talk at WPR.org if you want to send a message that way. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Our phone number, if you would like to join the conversation with Jeffrey Cabaservis, 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. In terms of, before we go to phone calls, we have many of them coming in, Jeffrey, in terms of how Trump presidency is going to operate in the world. We were hearing a lot about a nationalist movement that has been emerging in many European countries. We've heard about an alliance that he'd like to forge or a deeper friendship with Russia's President Putin. Do you have any indications, and is there a great deal of controversy among Republicans as how we venture forth in the world with a Trump presidency?
Oh, there's a great deal of concern on that score, of course. Republicans historically had been the party of stability and order, I suppose. And the idea that we might repudiate all of these treaty obligations that go back to the aftermath of World War II would strike a lot of traditional Republicans as very upsetting. Now, Trump has backed off from some of the more extreme statements on that score, but there's still a lot of uncertainty about how a Trump administration will function internationally and what that will mean for American leadership in the world.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about the potential Secretary of State?
Well, I actually talked to somebody who was on the Trump transition team last night.
Mm.
And he said that all the speculations that have appeared in the media so far have been mostly wrong.
Really?
And his reason for that was related to the question you raised about press bias. He said that the media was so sure that Trump was going to lose that they didn't bother to actually try to put any plants inside the Trump campaign or really establish relations with people who were likely to be on this transition team. So as a result, they're left completely flat-footed and in the dark about what's happening.
So the press should have maybe realized that this could happen, but nobody really realized this could happen, right?
I think it's always good for journalists to hedge their bets.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably a good idea for all of us to hedge our bets. When does an administration have to have all those pieces in place? Is it important to have your cabinet nominees in the next couple of weeks to reassure the world, to reassure the country? Can you wait longer than that?
That all depends on who they want to put forward. If these are going to be really controversial nominees, then perhaps it would be best to wait a while until the ground has been prepared, since some of them will have to perhaps seek confirmation.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. Tracy in Kenosha, hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, Tracy, how are you?
I am doing well.
Good.
I've got a question. Do you kind of feel that the press was really, really hard on Donald Trump and kind of shielded the public from a lot of Hillary Clinton's mishaps? Because that's what I've seen. So, and they kind of still are, you know what I mean?
Tracy, I'll take a quick stab at that. I think, in hindsight, a lot of Hillary Clinton's deficiencies became much more apparent to the press, and we've now seen much more searching examinations of her campaign shortcomings than we would have seen before. So, for example, Hillary Clinton didn't visit Milwaukee and didn't really bring out the emphasis that a lot of the labor union supporters of her were bringing out, which was the sort of inequality issue and Trump as a sort of a bad employer. It was all sort of on Trump's defects as a human being and his tape remarks. So, yeah, again, I think the press, was trying to some extent to be even-handed, but was just blindsided by the fact they didn't really pay as much attention to certain issues as they should have.
Mm-hmm. But everybody was blindsided. You were blindsided. Political pundits were blindsided. Everybody was blindsided.
Well, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I have a recollection of going on Fareed Zakaria's show on CNN a few months ago.
It's a good show.
And, he basically asked, is the Republican Party gone crazy because of the fact that Barack Obama is a black man? And I said, well, there's probably some element of racism involved in what's gone on. But I think really a lot of the Trump movement comes from economic distress, particularly in the American heartland. the fact that people are not getting ahead. They don't think the future is going to be as good for their children as it was for them and their parents. And he kind of just laughed that off and said, well, you know, every time I hear someone say something incredibly racist on the Republican side, everyone comments, oh, there goes another economically distressed voter. And all the panel sort of chortled, and these other much more eminent panelists then just kind of weighed on this theme that, yes, the Trump campaign was simply all about racism. So, yeah, I think there actually is a bias in the press, and I think that's partly because most people who work for the media simply don't get out much. They are subject to the Pauline Kael effect. She famously said, you know, how could Richard Nixon be president? I don't know anyone who voted for him.
Mm-hmm.
And when people live in the nice leafy suburbs of Washington, D.C., or in multimillion-dollar Manhattan apartments, or pleasant liberal college towns, they don't see a lot of Trump signs, they don't know a lot of Trump voters, and this cannot help but affect their analysis.
I know you're a Republican historian, but let's look at the role of the Democratic Party now in a Trump administration. You wrote in your piece throughout the Obama administration that GOP has had the mindset of an opposition party condemning policies without thinking deeply about how to reform them. What do you expect in the Trump administration with the Democrats not controlling much of anything?
Well, you know, I think the Democrats won't be as reflexively oppositional as many Republicans had been to President Obama, and that's partly because Democrats do still see themselves as the party of government. They want government to work well, and that means that they don't want to just throw a wrench into the machinery of government. Having said that, I think that people are underestimating the role that someone like Chuck Schumer is going to play as the minority leader in the Senate. I think an awful lot of deals are still going to have to be done through Chuck Schumer for major legislation to go.
Susan in Cottage Grove is next. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm old enough to remember the Nixon administration, and I certainly am not an enthusiast for the kinds of policies Mr. Trump has proposed, but I'm afraid he's going to do the let's have an enemies list, let's punish everybody who has expressed opposition to our views or tried to get in our way. Have you seen anything to tell me I'm being afraid for nothing?
Well, Susan, that's a good question because a Republican historian like me is bound to have fairly mixed views of Richard Nixon. On the one hand, yes, he did maintain the enemies list. Yes, he did introduce this note of hard-edged Southern populism into the Republican Party, in many ways shifted it towards the kind of rhetoric that Trump has used lately. On the other hand, Richard Nixon was an extremely intelligent, fairly pragmatic leader. He balanced the different factions of the Republican Party. He was able to escape capture by the bureaucracy. And he really did some significant things in terms of ending the draft, in terms of desegregating Southern schools, and bringing detente, and really the new world of globalization that we have with bringing China into the fold, I suppose, of the world economy. So, you know, people used to talk about the good Nixon and the bad Nixon, and eventually Nixon's presidency was undone by the bad Nixon and the tendency to want to punish enemies and go around constitutional restraints. Is there a good Trump and a bad Trump? I don't know. Certainly a lot of the rhetoric used in the campaign suggested that the bad Trump might be all there is, but on the other hand, Trump's victory statement was quite magnanimous, and he has so far chosen to forgive and try to work with those Republicans, at least, who disavowed him on the campaign trail.
Hmm.
So we'll just have to see.
What about this? She brought up an interesting point, and you just did, of persecuting enemies. Do you see a similarity between the way Trump has handled his enemies and the way that Richard Nixon did?
You know, one senses a certain similar bitterness in their rhetoric and outbursts. And, you know, with Nixon, I think there was simply less of a confident personality, perhaps, and just more of an acute sense of the hurt that the world had done to him. I don't see that so much in Trump, which sometimes makes you wonder whether it might be an act, a persona that he's adopted, again, for the sake of being the spiked baseball bat against the elites that those people who were hurting in the heartland wanted him to be.
Thanks, Susan, very much for your call. Let's go to Camille in New Berlin. Hi, Camille.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
The question was asked, what do we expect the GOP to do now that they have total complete power? And my answer to that would be just what you've seen Scott Walker do in the United States or in the state of Wisconsin.
Do you see a comparison, Jeffrey?
Well, I think it was Bill Kaplan from WisNow who kind of took off after me on that score. He said, look, you know, there's no reason to believe that the Republicans are going to adopt any sense of humility because they lost the popular vote. There's no reason to believe that they're going to walk slowly and carefully toward their goal, given that a lot of the people are against them. Just look to what Scott Walker has done. Scott Walker, I suppose, would say that to the victor belong the spoils, and if people don't like what he's done in Wisconsin, they are free to try to recall him again or vote him out in the next elections. I think it's really a question as to whether the people around Trump and the strategists in the Republican Party establishment think it's better to try to go slowly, pursue a more moderate course, try to win over a consensus rather than simply impose their will. That might depend on how long they think they're going to stay in power.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Ryan. And our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. What do the Republicans do now? They will soon control all branches of government. Our guest wrote a very interesting piece in the New York Times that looked at the answers to that question. He is Jeffrey Cabaservis, a historian of the Republican Party, author of Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. 800-486-8655 is our number. Ryan in Black River. Hi.
Hello. My statement on this is Obama has pushed his will for the last 8 years, going over 140 orders. So I guess I don't really see why this is really any different. If he does push through his agenda, because for one, he was elected by the people, so the things that he is pushing forward or moving forward are the things that the people that have to deal with.
Yeah, your phone is lousy, but we get what you're saying here. Is he going to use executive orders a lot? Did Obama use them too much, Jeffrey?
You know, you could certainly argue that Obama did use executive orders to excess, and that executive orders are not really what you want in a democracy. You would want some kind of legislative initiative to come from the party to achieve general assent from at least some members of the opposing party so that it can have bipartisan legitimacy. That's usually been the case with things that have endured in the American political order. It's not really the American political way to simply come in to power and repeal everything that the opposing party had put in. That's not the American way. And I think Trump, you know, will use some executive orders to repeal Obama's executive orders, but he also has a Congress that, for now, wants to work with him. And I think he will also want the added legitimacy that comes from passing his preferred ideas through the Congress and getting that kind of imprint of, like I said, democratic legitimacy on those ideas. Hmm. But, you know, there's a big question about what mandate, if any, Trump got from this election or what mandate the Republican Party got from this election. So already you're seeing stories that Paul Ryan thinks that the outcome of the election means that now is a great time to repeal Medicare. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but my guess is that that wasn't what most of the people who voted for Trump thought they were going to get.
Exactly. Ann is next in Green Bay. Hi, Ann.
Hello. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that President Obama used a lot of his executive powers because the Republicans refused to work with him. But that's not why I called. I called because I just wanted to remind you that Hillary did win the popular vote. And I'm just wondering what your feelings are about the Electoral College, and I would like to see that majorly changed. So,
thanks, Ann.
Well, Hillary did win the popular vote. But on the other hand, Trump ran a campaign that was designed to win him the Electoral College and hence the election. And I think actually Trump is right in this case when he says that if it was just a straight-up popular vote, that he would have run a campaign that was predicated on that assumption. So, you know, it's pretty rare that it's happened in American history that a presidential candidate has won the Electoral College without winning the popular vote. I think it's only happened 5 times. And it's not ideal. But on the other hand, he did win it fair and square.
Mm. Can you give us some information on this? I want to go back to what's happening in the transition team and and why certain people are out and certain people are in. This also will get a little bit to his son-in-law and how big an advisor he may be in the administration, the clearance he may have, whether or not that's proper for him to have a seat at the table for the morning briefings. But this whole Jared Kushner's father, who was the prosecutor in that case, was Chris Christie. Knowing a bit about the way Trump has operated with filing suits against people and those who file suits against him, it does seem a little strange, doesn't it, that Christie's people are now out because he was the prosecutor in Kushner's father's case?
You know, we're all kind of being reduced to the role of criminologists right now.
I know.
Not knowing enough about what's going on inside the inner circle, trying to look at what's happening and from there proceed through backwards rationalization to what we think might be the cause of it.
Right.
So it could be, you know, that Jared Kushner's father crossed Chris Christie or vice versa, and that's therefore why Christie was taken off the transition team, replaced by Pence, and the people who are close to Christie are now not getting through the Trump team. Or it could be, you know, that Chris Christie leaned over at dessert one night and ate Donald Trump's ice cream, and that's why he's now being exiled. I mean, we simply have no idea. Or it could be that none of this is connected to Chris Christie. We probably won't know until the people involved have written their memoirs, but at the least we should wait until we see what actually comes out in terms of the appointments.
You think we'll have to wait that long in this time of Twitter?
You know, we're used to things happening instantaneously.
I know.
But Trump has a very delicate balancing act to undertake right now, because he needs to reward the people who have been loyal to him. He needs to listen to his family and his closest advisors in terms of their advice, but he also needs to keep the peace within the Republican Party, and he also needs to create a functioning government, which means he is also going to have to reach back to the more quote-unquote establishment administrations of his predecessors, not just George W. Bush, but maybe even George H.W. and Ronald Reagan. His choices are going to upset people no matter what. If he chooses people who are going to brashly forge ahead in a Trumpian manner, then that's going to upset some people. If he chooses people who will maintain a steady hand on the tiller, that's going to upset the people who wanted a more daring course. Mm. So I think that's the real reason for the delay that we're seeing right now.
Well, from what I've read about him, and certainly you look at how many Republicans supported him, he didn't have overwhelming support. He had a lot of people who wanted to stay pretty far away from him. Does he have enough people who were loyal to him during the campaign and in his life that he'll be able to reward them with key positions in the government? Or does he not have that many people?
Well, you know, it's true that Trump really ran against the Republican Party establishment, and that turned out in hindsight to have been why he succeeded, because people were in a very anti-establishment mood in both parties. Let's not leave out the Bernie Sanders phenomenon here.
Right.
But the reality is also that Trump has 4,000 positions to fill in the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously there's more positions than there are loyalists, but also the fact that victory changes a lot of things. So a lot of people who had vowed that they would never be Trump are now doing what the Brits call a reverse ferret and are sending their resumes in hoping to be considered for some assistant secretaryship somewhere. So if anything, the problem is going to be too many people becoming March Violets, people who recently converted to the cause of Trumpism and wanting to be rewarded.
That's a lot of positions to fill, isn't it, Jeff?
It is a lot of positions to fill, yes.
Let's go to Marlene in Wauwatosa. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. Okay, I'm going to try not to hyperventilate during this discussion and comment. Jeffrey, I believe?
Yes, correct.
I decided this morning that I was not going to accept the acquaintances or / friends, people that I've known for years, if they have voted for Trump and they decide on their own that they can just start talking to me about it, and that I wasn't going to say anything, which I didn't want to do. But your comments, oh, man, slow down. Your comments about this good Trump, bad Trump, or not-so-good Trump is unbelievable to me. How could anyone say that they would give their vote to a man who berates and belittles? What brings to mind is just if you take one instance where he has done that to a journalist with a disability, How can you justify that? And I'm also offended by that, wrap it up under economic ribbon. Isn't there, okay, isn't
right,
there some type of phrase that goes something like, well, we know what you are, we just need to decide on the price?
But Marlene, he won the presidency, so, and he's going to be president for at least 4 years. What are you going to do with that?
Oh, you know what? As I said this morning, and I really do believe that people are entitled to their opinions and all, but not this.
Hmm. Jeffrey?
Well, Marlene, thank you for your question. And the way you have phrased it reinforces everything I've ever heard about Midwestern niceness. So thank you for that. You know, this is obviously an unusual election. Trump is not a normal candidate. This has not been a normal election. And, you know, I've also been taken aback, as have indeed many Republican members of Congress and Republicans, by a lot of what Trump has said in his past campaign. And not just his insult of the disabled New York Times reporter, but a lot of what he said about women, minorities, you know, you can go on and on. And I've often asked a lot of his supporters why they're not equally offended by this and why Trump's remarks from day one of his candidacy were not deal breakers for them. And, you know, I think a lot of people interpret it as a lot of politics is about acting, which is true. Politics is more like the stage than any other profession you can think of outside of the theater. And we don't know, frankly, whether Trump said a lot of these things for effect. My suspicion is that he probably did. I mean, after all, in 1999, he was considering running for the presidency as the candidate of the Reform Party. And what he was saying then was that the Republican Party is in danger of becoming a white party. It's not open enough to minorities. It's not open enough to social change. So he's either had this complete turnaround since then, or he looked and saw that there was an opening for him to be this kind of mean bullying guy who would say what a lot of people wanted him to say. But again, I think you have to judge the Trump presidency by the actions that he's going to take rather than the rhetoric that he used in his campaign. And I realize that that's kind of harsh and realpolitik, and I apologize to those of you who are offended, and I understand that many people feel a need to oppose Trump and oppose the normalization of talking about his administration. But I think that's the most prudent, realistic course for everyone going forward. If you want to defriend all of your friends who voted for Trump, if you want to never talk to a Trump supporter again, you know, I suppose you can do that. But that's not ultimately the way to get to the better, more united America that most people said they wanted before the election results came in.
That united America is going to be one tough cookie in the next few years.
Absolutely.
It's not going to be easy.
But yeah, we weren't all that united, frankly, before
exactly.
Donald Trump
right.
threw his hat in the ring.
Yeah. Jacqueline sends this email. Many Trump supporters I know are middle class, upper middle class in Dodge, Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington, and counties in Wisconsin. These people are not poor, powerless people. What do you, Jeffrey, make of that?
You know, we're still sorting through that, those of us who are trying to make sense of this election, and I have heard the statistic that the average Trump voter or supporter makes $72,000 a year, which actually is considerably more than I make. I'm not sure I believe it, though, and that's because I'm just coming back from traveling through rural Virginia, Tennessee, and seeing an awful lot of people who are in plainly dire straits, materially speaking, festooning their yards with Trump signs. And, you know, one billionaire in that mix can affect that a lot. I think the most interesting and convincing reporting on this election has been from Alec MacGillis, formerly of the New Republic, now with ProPublica. And he's also spent a lot of time in Appalachia. And his basic view is that the very poorest of the poor are not Trump supporters. They, in fact, benefit from a lot of social welfare programs, and they would like to keep them. But these are people whose lives are so chaotic that they can't really vote at all, let alone actively involve themselves in a political campaign. And it's the people who are really just a step or two on the ladder above mm-hmm. those people, who in some cases might be their relatives, friends, ex-spouses, who, you know, look at these people leading chaotic lives and fear that chaos reaching up to them. And that's a large part of why they're voting Trump.
Mm. Yeah, I forgot about that piece. It was a very good piece.
Tremendous.
Yeah, it was good. More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. When Republicans take power. Jeffrey Cabaservice is our guest. We have one line open. We've been busy here, but It's open to you right now if you want to take it. Back to your phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network, and we'll be with you momentarily. All right, Keith in Madison, hello.
Hello, yes, I hope Trump is never normalized. I think people are right to protest, and I think the protests are going to grow over time, and they're just getting started. Now, one of the most distressing and frightening aspects of this, of a prospect of a Trump presidency, is that he's going to let the global fossil fuel industry continue to emit more fossil fuel, CO2 gases. It's already causing the planet to warm up. And on the day of the election, on November 8th, they held a meeting in Morocco about the temperature, the rise of temperature in the past 5 years. I guess it's accelerated quite a bit, and the glaciers are starting to melt, and sea rise is it's worse than they even predicted. So we are heading right off a cliff with this president. And I do hope the protests continue to grow. I hope he is driven out of power, and I hope he doesn't even see the inauguration day. He needs to be gone.
Jeffrey.
I've heard a lot of that in the last several days. And in fact, much of downtown Washington, D.C. was shut down last night by protests that were not just against Trump, but also against the proposed pipeline at Standing Rock, North Dakota.
Big protests in D.C., huh?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. And, you know, these have gone on in our area, in schools, across this region, and, of course, across the country, or much of the country. So, yeah, I mean, this is a much more divisive aftermath of the election than anything I can remember seeing, and anything that I can really remember in American history going back perhaps to the 1850s. But again, the question is what's going to happen. I think the belief that Trump will be somehow removed before Election Day, or indeed before 2020, is perhaps wishful thinking. And I also think that Trump has it within his power to tear up a lot of the achievements of the environmental movement going back 50 years. And this was one of the consequences of the election, and elections do have consequences, and I hate to say it, but the Democratic will prevailed in this case. And, you know, what I think is going to happen, and what I wrote about in my piece, is that there are a lot of Republicans who live in states that are along the coast. And if global warming does accelerate, if that 2 degrees Celsius warming target is missed, as seems likely now, these are the areas that are going to be severely impacted. And we're going to see a lot of other kinds of severe weather patterns. And this eventually may shift the opinion within the Republican Party towards a belief in environmentalism and climate change. But the reality is that, you know, environmentalism has not been a bipartisan cause for a number of years now. And when you get a cause that lacks the legitimacy, again, that comes from being supported by at least some elements of both parties, it is vulnerable to going away when its opponent takes office.
Do you think we already have reached the point? A lot of climate scientists have talked about the number of hurricanes, about what's happening, as Keith just mentioned, with ice caps melting, that the signs are so omnipresent now, with forest fires, with what's happening in the oceans, with wildlife, with an increase in temperature, that it's reached a point where it's almost too late to come to some consensus on this, because it's obvious what's happening.
You know, I think there is an overwhelming and irrefutable consensus among the world scientists that global warming is happening and getting worse. I'm not sure there's an equal consensus that it is past a point of no return and that the impact is irreversible. We'll have to see.
Thanks for the call, Keith. Nick in Greenfield. Hi, Nick.
Yes, hi. Thank you, and thank you for your article. I want to look that up and read it. But my point today is about the establishment Republicans and how the Tea Party is kind of like the tail wagging the dog, pushing them, because their big thing is they keep railing against the regulations. And I'd like to just give you two quick examples of regulations. One was we had so many more instances of Ebola, not Ebola, but meat having to be recalled because the Republicans fought against the regulations of putting enough food inspectors around the nation. That's one. And the other one, real quickly, about regulations is the BP oil spill, where the regulations that were in place were not being enforced by the Republican administration under Bush. So my whole point is, do you see any possibility that the establishment Republicans are going to push Trump into all of this deregulation, which is really bad for the economy and the citizens and the nation? Because
all right, thanks, Nick, very much. What do you think, Jeffrey?
Thanks for your question, Nick. Sure, I do think that deregulation is one of the things on which Trump and the majority of the Republicans in Congress are agreed. And to your point, yes, you're right. There can be disastrous consequences from a lack of regulation or a lack of financial support for the regulatory apparatus. And you certainly could have added the example of lead poisoning in Flint, Michigan, to that list. You know, the amount that we will have to pay and the damage that we've suffered both to our own citizens and really our image in the world far exceeds what it would have cost in regulation and money to support that regulation. On the other hand, you know, you could also argue that regulation has simply reached such a volume and complexity that it's really gone beyond the level that most people are prepared to tolerate, even in the interest of risk. It's sort of like life insurance. You know, at some point, if life insurance cost you $100,000 a year, you might not be into it, even if you knew you might need it at some point. And so I think there's really an art of regulation and finding the right balance. And I think the Democrats did go far to one side. I hope the Republicans don't go too far to the other side.
Kevin is next in Crandon. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Yeah, I just find your Republican guys feeling that, you know, the numerically superior amount of people that didn't vote for Trump, that we should all now just get together and go along with whatever Paul Ryan wants to do and so on and so forth. Ludicrous. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Kevin. Is Kevin and people who share his opinion, are they going to change?
You know, again, it really depends on how the Republicans in Congress interpret whatever mandate they received in this election, and also whether what they want is compatible with what Donald Trump thinks they ought to be doing. And again, you know, Trump and Ryan have made nice over the last week. But there's still a great contradiction between what Paul Ryan would like the government to do and what Donald Trump has said he would like the government to do. And you can't really have both. You can't do away with Medicare and also be the person who's going to bring good times again to the working classes in the heartland. So we'll just have to see how those negotiations work out.
We have about a minute left. You mentioned Mitch McConnell, who was wary of repeating the overreach that occurred last time Republican controlled all three branches. What's he worried about, and what's he going to do about it?
Well, you know, again, in 2005, when George W. Bush was taking office with all three branches of government behind him, he thought he had a mandate to privatize Social Security, at least partially privatize it. And it turns out he didn't, and it was one of the bigger failures of his presidency. By the same token, I think most people would say that Bush overreached in trying to reorder the Middle East. And this ultimately led to, first of all, the Democrats retaking control of Congress, and then Barack Obama being elected to two terms as president. So if the Republicans would like to avoid that kind of overreach followed by a backlash against them, followed by losing power, I think people like McConnell think that it's incumbent upon them to follow a more prudent course.
We will see. Jeffrey, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting hour. Our guest, Jeffrey Cabaservis, with us this first hour of our program today, historian of the Republican Party, author of Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the program. Thanks to Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Coming up the next hour of the program, I think this will be a really good discussion and an important one, the role of the press in covering a Trump administration, how the Trump administration views the press. We'll be talking about that with two different guests, media columnist for The Washington Post, and with one of the first people at the Poynter Institute who wrote about his awakening after the 2004 election. You'll find that story interesting. So that's coming up. What do you think about how the press covered Trump and what he thinks of the press coming up?